fast forward you to my website, and you can click on the resources button. That's where you'll find this form. I'm going to walk us through it, so it's important that you have this and can look at this. It's too hard to kind of just describe verbally, so make sure you get this and download it. And complete the form right now, by the way, as we do this together. You can write directly on that form, of course, or if you have the printed out copy of Profit First, write right into the book. Just, you know, don't write on your iPad or something like that. All right, now we're working with the chart. I want you to go to cell A1, and that's the column that says actual, and the horizontal line, the row, says top line revenue. In the actual column, cell A1, enter your top line revenue for the last 12 full months. This is your total revenue from sales and should be the top line, or near it, on your P&L. One of the common labels for the top line is total income, total sales, revenue, sales, or net sales. A2, and again, that refers to cell A2. If you're a manufacturer, retailer, or more than 25% of your sales are derived from the resale or assembly of inventory, put the cost of materials, not labor, for the last full 12 months in the material and sub-cell, A2. This is not, I repeat, this is not the same as cost of goods sold. And I can't tell you how many emails I get about this saying, hey, is materials and subs the same as cost of goods sold? It's not. It is not. So don't just put that number in there. And again, follow that rule, that 25%. If you're a service-based business providing services, chances are you have zero that goes in here. No way is 25% of your costs derived from materials. So for most service-based businesses, I'd say 99.9% of them, this number in this cell is always zero. And again, this is only for materials, and only if your material costs 25% or more of your sales. 3, if subcontractors deliver the majority of your service, put the cost of the subcontractors for these 12 months in the material and sub-cell, A2. Subcontractors, so we're clear, subcontractors are people who work for you on a project basis but have the ability to work autonomously and have the ability to work for others. You don't pay them on payroll. You pay them their project fee, commission, or hourly rate, and they handle their taxes, benefits, etc. themselves. In some cases, you will have both materials and subcontractor costs. Think home construction. In that case, put the cumulative amount of these two costs into cell A2. Remember to put only your materials and subcontractors here, but not the labor of your own people. 4, if you are a service company and the majority of your services are provided by your employees, yourself included, put 0 into cell A2. 5, if your material or subcontractor costs are less than 25% of your top line revenue, also put 0 in cell A2. We will account for these expenses. Don't worry about it. We will account for these expenses in the operating expense in a little bit. 6, if you are unsure of what to put in the material and subsection, put 0. Do not overthink this, and do not use it to make nominal adjustments. The goal here is only to adjust your company's revenue to represent what it really makes as revenue. If the majority of cost is for materials, supplies, or subcontractors. Again, if you are even a wee bit unsure, put 0 in material and subs. It will serve you better in the long run by making you more critical of your costs. 7. Now subtract your material and subs number from your top line revenue to calculate your real revenue. If you put an NA in the material and subs section, or a 0, just copy the top line revenue to the real revenue cell, A3. 8. The goal here is to get you to your real revenue number. This is the real money your company makes. For the other stuff, subs, materials, etc., you may make a margin, but it isn't the core driver of profitability because you have little control over it. This can be a real wake-up moment for entrepreneurs. The real estate agency that does $5 million in annual revenue and has a couple dozen agents, subcontractors, taking $4 million in commissions, is really a $1 million business that manages real estate agents making $4 million. It's not a $5 million business. The $3 million a year staffing firm that bills out subcontractors to do work and pays those subs $2.5 million is really a $500,000 business. The architectural firm that bills out $2 million in annual fees and has in-house staff that does practically all the work has real revenue of $2 million a year. The real revenue number is a simple, fast way to put all companies on equal footing, their real revenue numbers. Real revenue is different than gross profit, in that real revenue is your total revenue minus materials and subcontractors utilized to create and deliver the service or product. Gross profit, on the other hand, is an accounting term calculated as total revenue minus materials, subcontractors, and any of your employees' time utilization to create and deliver the service or product. It is a subtle difference, but a critically important one. Gross profit includes a portion of your employees' time and your time. But the important thing is this: you will generally pay your employees for their time regardless of whether you have a bad sales day or a good one. You will likely pay them the same if they fix a car transmission in 4 hours or five. So, to simplify things, we categorize any employee that you have, full or part-time, as a cost of the business operation, not as a cost of the goods sold. Plus, gross profit can be manipulated by moving numbers around. What good is that? We want to make clear sense of your numbers, so avoid using anything but the cost you incur in materials and subs when calculating real revenue for the instant assessment. 9. Now that we know your real revenue, let's start with profit first. See how that works? Write down your actual profit from the last 12 months in the profit cell A4. This is the cumulative profit you have sitting in the bank or have distributed to yourself and or your partners as a bonus on top of, but not to supplement, your salary, your regular compensation. If you think you have a profit, but it is not in the bank and was never distributed to you as a bonus, this means you don't really have a profit. If it turns out that you have less profit than you thought you would, it is likely used to pay down debt from previous years, or maybe you are attempting an Enron remake. 10. In the owner's comp cell, which is A5, put down how much you paid yourself and any other owners in the business these past 12 months in regular payroll distributions, not profit distributions. Before we continue on here, I just want to make a very clear distinction between profit and owner's comp. It's probably actually best we start with owner's comp. Owner's comp is your regular form of income coming in as an owner of the business from the business. Now, you may take it in distributions. If you have an LLC, so often you do a distribution. But if you have a C-Corp or S-Corp, you may be on payroll. If you have another form of organization, maybe you have a hybrid. But the key here is any money that you take with regularity to support your lifestyle, that's owner's comp. Profit is money that you take out, regardless of the form of how you take it out, but profit is the money you take out above and beyond as a reward for yourself. The old year-end bonus. If you do that, that's likely a profit distribution. Now, I'm suggesting you don't do this once a year and profit first, we're going to do it quarterly. But anything you do to compensate yourself, usually on a more randomized basis, and supports your above your normal lifestyle of owner's comp, that's what we call a profit. So that's how you distinguish the two. 11. In the tax cell, A6, put down how much tax your company has paid on your behalf. This is critical. This is not how much you have paid in taxes. This is how much your company paid or reimbursed you in taxes. Tax is both the income tax of all the owners and any other corporate taxes. The likelihood that your company paid your taxes for you is very low, and we'll fix that too. So chances are you will put a big fat zero in that section. If your income tax got deducted from your paycheck from your company, or at the end of the year, you had to scratch together cash out of your pocket, the company definitely did not pay your taxes, and a big zero goes in that cell A6. Again, I want to point this out because this is another point of confusion. Again, taxes is what your company has paid on your behalf, meaning has your company written a tax check out to the government for you? Then your company's paid your taxes. Or has the company written a check out to you saying, here's the reimbursement for the taxes taken out of your paycheck? Then the company's paid your taxes. If neither of those have happened, your company has not paid your taxes. And that's the likely scenario. It's very rare that a company pays your taxes on your behalf. But with profit first, we're going to make it very not rare, very normal. 12. In the operating expense cell, A7, add up the total expenses your business paid for the last 12 months. Everything except your profit, owner's comp, tax, and any materials and subcontractors that you have already accounted for. The expenses are listed on your income statement. Now, here is where people get confused. It's okay if the numbers don't match up perfectly. This is not accounting, and you don't need to reconcile to the penny. This is simply a system that gets us in the ballpark of where we are and then tells us where we need to start going. The goal is not to have perfect numbers. It is just to understand roughly where we stand now. And with the understanding, we can start working on a profit plan for your business. This is simply a starting point. As we implement profit first over time, we will automatically adjust and nail the perfect numbers for your business. Just get started. Double check your work by adding up your profit, that's cell A4, owner's comp, cell A5, taxes, A6, and operating expenses, A7, to see if you get your real revenue number, that was cell A3. If you don't get this number, something's off. Double check your numbers to see if you missed something. Once you make sure all the numbers are as accurate as possible, adjust the operating expense number up or down to get the real revenue to balance. This makes many accounting professionals squeamish. I get it. But again, the goal is just to get in the ballpark. We aren't looking to master accounting here. Now, add your real revenue to the material and sub costs, and you should get the top line revenue number. Make sure it all squares out. Now that you have the hard work done in the first column, we can plug in the easy stuff. 13. Next, enter the profit percentages in the TAP column based upon your real revenue range. Fill in cells B4 through B7. Use the percentages in Figure 4. Now, Figure 4 is the TAPS chart. I studied all these fiscally elite companies, these very healthy companies, about 1,000 companies, and did this analysis for the health of these companies in different ranges, and specifically what they were allocating to different purposes: profit, tax, owner's pay. So that, of course, is also downloadable off my website. I call these percentages TAPs, and TAP stands for Target Allocation Percentages, the percentage of each deposit that you will allocate to different elements of your business. TAPs are not, and I got to underline this 1,000 times, TAPs are not your starting point. TAPs are the targets you are moving toward. For example, if your real revenue for the last 12 months is $722,000, you should use column C from Figure 4, the TAPS chart. If your business has $225,000 in real revenue, in that case, you'd use column A. If you run a division or have your own company that does $40 million, use column F. So that's how you find the TAPS. And remember, and I got to underline it one more time, TAPS is not your starting point. Those are your targets. That's what we're going to want to move you toward over time, but we're going to start with different, easier percentages and build our way there. 14. In the PF dollar sign column, copy the real revenue number from your actual column, that was cell A3, to the PF dollar sign real revenue cell C3. Then multiply the real revenue number by the TAP for each row and write down the number in the corresponding PF dollar sign cell. For example, to determine your PF dollar sign profit, multiply C3, that was the real revenue, by B4, profit TAPs, to get C4. The profit first dollar target for profit. Do the same process to calculate each cell in the PF dollar sign column. These are your target profit first dollar amounts for each category. Welcome to the moment of truth. I hope we can still be friends. 15. In the delta column, take your actual number and subtract the PF dollar sign number. This is very likely to result in a negative number for profit or owner's comp or operating expenses, or all three. It is your delta, the amount you need to make up. Negative means you are bleeding money in these sections. Sometimes it is just one category with a problem, but in most cases, businesses are bleeding out in the profit, owner's comp, and tax accounts and have positive numbers, meaning excess in operating expenses. In other words, we are paying too little in profit, owner's comp, and taxes, and paying too much in operating expenses. 16. The final column, fix, will have no numbers, only the word increase or decrease next to each category. If the number in the delta section is a negative number, put increase in the corresponding fix cell, because we need to increase our contribution to this category to correct the delta. Conversely, if it is a positive number in the delta section, put decrease in the fix cell, since this is a category where we need to spend less money in order to fix it. What do these percentages and numbers mean? Now, again, I'm referring to figure 4. I mentioned it only a few seconds ago. This is the TAPS chart. So in this section of the book, I want to explain what it is to you. I hope you can download it and take a peek at it while I read through it. If you can't, just bear with me. I think you can figure it out. You're smart. You're a smart bloke anyway. All right, here we go. The numbers in figure 4 are typical ranges that I have found while working with countless companies over the years and in running my own. And they represent what I have found to be very healthy numbers. But here is the deal. The percentages aren't perfect, but they are an excellent starting point. When you run your instant assessment, chances are you will find that your actual percentages are nowhere near the numbers in figure 4. But that is okay, because these percentages are only your targets, what you will move toward. We're going to approach these targets in small steps. More on that soon, but here are the details behind the percentages. In determining these target allocation percentages, the TAPs in figure 4, I sorted companies into 6 tiers. When a company is doing less than $250,000 in revenue, it typically has one employee, you. You are the key employee, and usually the only employee, maybe with some contractors, part-timers, or possibly one full-timer. Many freelancers are at this stage, and if they elect to stay, just them and no employees, they should be able to increase the profit and pay percentages even more than I have listed, because they don't have the expense of employees or the need to incur the expenses necessary to support multiple employees. At $250,000 to $500,000, you likely have employees. Basic systems will be necessary, like a shared CRM for your team. A CRM, by the way, is a customer relationship management tool. Equipment and other things. Plus, you'll need to pay your people, so operating expenses increase. Owner's comp adjusts down, and will continue to, as you take your first step to being a little less employee and a little more shareholder, when other people start to do the work and you get the benefit of the profits via your distributions. At $500,000 to $1 million in revenue, the growth trend and patterns continue with more systems and more people. Focus on increasing profits, because for so many businesses, the growth from $1 million to $5 million is the hardest. You will want a little reserve. From $1 million to $5 million. Systems are no longer added because they are nice to have. Now systems become absolutely mandatory. You can't keep it all in your head anymore. Often, the biggest investment into the business needs to happen at this time, as all the knowledge in your head needs to be converted into systems and processes and checklists. This means larger allocations must be put forward toward operating expenses. This is when you are no longer doing most of the work. This is when, if your business is to grow, a significant portion of your time is spent working on the business, not in it, and the rest of your time is spent selling the big projects. At $5 million to $10 million in revenue, typically a management team enters a company to bring it to the next stage, and a clear second tier of management starts to form. The founder starts more and more to focus on her special strengths. The owner is on a consistent payroll, and the majority of her take-home income is from the profitability of the company, not the salary she takes. At $10 million to $50 million in revenue, a business will often stabilize and achieve predictable growth. The founder's income is almost entirely made up of profit distributions. Owner's salaries are relative to their roles, but typically are insignificant. Businesses of this size can leverage efficiency in big ways to maximize profitability. And if you were reading the book, now I go into figure 5, which is a completed instant assessment. And let's go back to the book. Figure 5 is a completed example from a law firm to which I just introduced this process. The instant assessment reveals a few painful things. This business is not nearly profitable enough. It should be filling the profit coffers by an additional $118,000, that's cell D4 in the chart in the book, every year. At $5,000 in the profit account, this is basically a break-even business. One bad month, and this company will go under. The two owners are taking a combined salary of $190,000, that's cell A5, which is way too much for a business of this size. The owners are likely living a bigger lifestyle than the business can afford, and they need to cut their salaries by $67,000. As the business gets healthier, the taxes are likely to increase. More taxes, as painful as they are a sign of a healthy business. The more you make, the more you pay, until you make so much you lobby politicians and pay nothing. Don't get me started. Do not get me started. And those operating expenses are too high, to the tune of more than $140,000. Looking at this instant assessment, it's obvious what this company's leaders need to do to make the business healthy. Cut owner salaries and cut operating costs, possibly including staff. This will free up cash flow for profit, which we need to improve, and allow us to reserve more cash for the owners and business tax responsibilities. It will require courage, and it's going to be painful. And I may mention this later in the book, but I want to mention it now. I am not a fan of cutting staff. Sometimes you have to do it. Sometimes a business is so overstaffed and our ego gets in the way that we are willing to save one person while sinking the entire ship of the business. We sometimes have to face the reality that we, the owners, made a bad mistake. We overhired. We got to face the brutal truth, tell our employees that it's our fault, and then, unfortunately, let go of the people that shouldn't have been there in the first place. It's difficult. I've been there. It's gut-wrenching. I've cried when I had to do the layoffs because of my own foolish mistakes. But if the business is going to survive, we must make it profitable. And sometimes that's one of the hard decisions you need to make. And hopefully the employees that are no longer with you are better off because they're going on to a company that is more profitable from the get-go. But you're going to fix your business, and then one day you can maybe invite them back or get other employees on board and never have to go through that process again of letting people go. The instant assessment brings clarity fast, and it can be a rude awakening. No more putting things off. No more hoping that big client, big check, or big anything will save you from the day-to-day panic. We know exactly what you need to do. A financially healthy company is a result of a series of small, daily financial wins, not one big moment. Profitability isn't an event. It's a habit. Don't panic. You might remember that during my rebuilding period, I wrote my first book, The Toilet Paper Entrepreneur, the foundation of which was a series of principles I used to start my businesses. Chief among these principles was frugality. I wholeheartedly believe that any entrepreneur could start a business with little or no seed money and grow that business no matter what they had in the bank. The book is full of tips for saving money while launching a business and running a business. And since its original publication, I've heard from thousands of entrepreneurs who followed the advice, or a variant thereof, while starting or operating their own businesses. And let me tell you, I didn't just spout off about frugality. After my spending craze, after my come to Jesus moment, if Jesus were another name for near bankruptcy, I went back to my roots, way back. Not because I had to this time, but because I wanted to. I made it my mission to get what I needed for my business on the cheap and took pride in doing so. My office space cost a mere $1,000 per month, peanuts compared to my previous $14,000 a month digs. I got my gently used conference room furniture for a whopping 75% discount. My dry erase board was homemade with whiteboard material used to make showers, dental floss, and some car wax. Top that, MacGyver. It's all true, by the way. So, imagine my surprise when I ran my own assessment on my business and discovered that despite my frugal superpowers, I was still bleeding out. It is not an exaggeration to say I was shocked to discover this. How much cheaper can I get this stuff? I thought, beyond frustration. Then I realized, duh. It wasn't how much I was spending on expense line items. The problem was, I shouldn't have been spending anything on some of those line items. For example, I don't really need an office space. I wasn't seeing clients or greeting customers. I was writing a book and building a speaking career, which meant I spent a lot of time alone, on the road, and in phone and Skype meetings. My subcontractors could just as easily do their work from home. Truth was, I wanted an office space because it made me feel legitimate. And after my piggy bank moment, I needed to feel that. But the bottom line was, I couldn't keep it up if I wanted to turn a profit every month. So I sublet my office space and found a sweet deal at a cookie factory. Free office and meeting space from a trusted longtime friend. Thank you, Howard Hirsch. I will never forget what you did for me. I cut expense line items across the board until I stopped the bleeding and watched my business and profit grow. an added bonus was free cookies. And when I say an added bonus, I mean a bonus of about 5 pounds around my waist. So not really a bonus after all. In the year since I had that realization, cutting costs has become an almost enjoyable strategic challenge. But to enjoy the process, you first must have to face some harsh truths. I have applied the instant assessment to countless businesses, and the reactions vary from, "Really? I can do that?" to, "Who the hell do you think you are, Mike, telling me where my business should be? You know nothing about my unique industry." To buckling knees and tears streaming down people's faces. It's hard to face the harsh reality that your business is worse off than you thought it was. But now you know, and knowledge is power. Now we can fix it. You are not a fool. You've done nothing wrong, and you have nothing to be ashamed of. You have this book now. You are discovering the truth and another way to get where you want to go. You are no longer asking, "How can I make my business bigger?" You are asking, "How can I make my business better?" If your business is brand new, how does Profit First work if you just launched your business and have no revenue? Should you wait until you have some to start using Profit First? Heck no. Starting with squat, with your whole business future ahead of you, is actually the best time to start using Profit First. Why? Because it allows you to form a powerful habit right from the get-go, when your business is forming, and, perhaps more important, prevents you from developing bad financial habits that can be difficult to break. Also, in the early stages of building a business, you need to spend as much time as possible on the selling and the doing. Systems and processes come later. For these reasons, it's best not to worry about getting the exact right percentages for your business. Simply use the percentages in the instant assessment for your target allocations, but start at 1% allocation for the profit account. Why 1%? You'll find out in the next chapter. 50% for owner's comp and 15% for the tax account. Use quarterly adjustments to step up to higher percentages and nudge your business closer to the taps recommended in this book. And as for the advanced Profit First strategies I share at the end of the book, don't worry about any of that until your business has been active for at least a year. The goal for new businesses is to form the basic core of the Profit First good habit and then spend every other waking second getting your baby off the ground. Take action. Complete the instant assessment. Step one, the one and only step. This entire chapter is really one big action step. So if you've not yet completed an instant assessment on your business, do it now. Can you get a lot more out of this book if you table this exercise for when you have more time or feel up to facing reality? Sure. Will you get the most out of reading this book and see results quickly if you don't? Nope. So stop right now and do it. I'm waiting. Do it now. Please listen to this. If you are feeling overwhelmed, bad about yourself, and the choices you've made, or angry about the numbers you came up with in the instant assessment, there is something I want you to know. You are normal. Totally, completely, 100% normal. If you are having trouble facing the rest of this book right now, that's okay. Stop now and come back to it when you feel ready to face it. But do this one thing. Set up a profit account at a separate bank. And every time you make a deposit, move 1% into that account. I know it's peanuts, and you may think that amount is too small to make an impact on your business. But that is the reason you're going to keep the profit allocation percentage low. You can run your business as you always have, and you won't feel a thing. But you will start the habit that will change your business forever. Soon enough, the feeling of being overwhelmed, the anger and frustration will fade as your new profit habit builds. Then you can crack this book again and dig into the rest of the Profit First system. Chapter 5, Allocation Percentages. Years ago, a colleague shared a powerful story with me about hitting financial targets. An up-and-coming motivational speaker went to a speaking boot camp. During one of the sessions, the instructor explained how to make back-of-the-room sales. He said, "When you follow this method, 80% of the audience will buy your product at the end of the event." With pages of notes and tons of enthusiasm, our up-and-comer set forth on the speaking circuit. Initially, she closed only 25% of her audiences. Reaching for that 80%, she tweaked and improved her strategy and pitched, constantly reviewing her notes. Over time, her close rate rose to 50%, then 60%. After another year, she was consistently selling 75% of the room after her speech. She'd achieved outstanding results, but not to the level her instructor had promised. One morning, she sat down to breakfast with a few colleagues, and her old instructor happened to be there. She couldn't wait to speak with him and get direction about what could help her get that last elusive 5%. What was the secret to finally breaking 80%? When she told her story to her instructor, his jaw dropped. 80%? You thought I said 80%? I said 18. I tell you this story to illustrate something I believe to be true because I've experienced it. No matter what the number is, if you work toward it and believe it's a possibility, you will not only achieve it, you will blow past the reasonable numbers others have set. Profit First works on so many levels. It begins with setting allocation percentages, the amount you will transfer to profit, owner's comp, and tax accounts, which we will sort out in this chapter. By the end of this chapter, you will have a customized assessment of your business. If you'd rather jump right in and start implementing Profit First, turn to Chapter 6. You can always come back to this chapter later and tweak your percentages. Either way, as long as you're actually working on the Profit First system, you're winning. Two common problems. The instant assessment is based on ranges. Every business is slightly different, though your business and your industry are not nearly as unique as you may think. The numbers you came up with in the instant assessment won't be perfect, but they are probably close to what you'll end up with after a more detailed assessment. Before we dig in, I want to address two common problems entrepreneurs face when they decide to start following the Profit First system, and they do not go hand in hand. First, don't get bogged down in the details. First, some entrepreneurs make the mistake of getting trapped in the details, spending hours, days, weeks, or longer perfecting their percentages before they do anything. Worse, some entrepreneurs who get stuck in the minutia never get around to doing anything. It's our old nemesis, analysis paralysis. In this chapter, we get down to the nitty-gritty, but if at any time you think you are lost in a research and percentage-tweaking rabbit hole, stop and move on to the next chapter. Perfectionism kills every dream. Better to just start. Second, look before you leap. On the other hand, if you're like me, you might make the common mistake of taking action too big and too fast. I'm the type who starts before I have all the information because most of the learning occurs in the doing anyway. But I put success at risk when I go into a situation ill-prepared. In those cases, my ego blames the system when mistakes were simply due to the fact that I didn't put in the necessary preparation. I've seen entrepreneurs kickstart their profit-first system by taking a profit percentage of 20% immediately. They say, "This is so simple, I get it, bammo, 20%, I'm done, next problem." Not so fast, Chiefy. This is a classic mistake, one I've made myself. Going full throttle into Profit First on the first day is like donating 5 gallons of blood at your first blood drive. You know what would happen if you tried to do that? You would die. The body has less than 2 gallons of blood pumping through it, so you'd keel over way before you ever reached your 5-gallon goal anyway. However, there is a way to reach your goal in a safe way. If we donate small amounts over time, eventually we will donate 5 gallons, cumulatively. The target allocation percentages, which we call TAPs, are simply the targets you are moving toward. To be clear, TAPs are not, I repeat, not your starting point. I derive the TAPs from surveys and evaluations of approximately 1,000 of the most fiscally elite companies across all industries and of all sizes, as well as an analysis of some of the thousands of companies who have implemented Profit First and, as a result, joined the fiscally elite. Aspire to move toward the TAPs. At any point, you may be thinking, "Mike, you don't know my industry. I could never hit those numbers." This is when I have to bring out the big guns. People like Henry Ford, who said, "If you think you can or think you can't, you're right." Be optimistic when you assume profit capabilities for your business or your industry. In other words, think you can. Your business may currently have better numbers than the TAPs. If that's you, congratulations. This does not mean you can slow things down, however. You still need to push yourself. Try to become the elite of the elite. Now, let me talk one more time. Just want to share this as an aside about the TAPs. Many people come to me and say, I can never do those numbers. My industry doesn't have numbers like that. I'm in the manufacturing world. I can't do that. And we find excuses. But quite frankly, they just are excuses. I know this for real because I own a manufacturing business. I already referred to them. I'm a co-owner in a manufacturing business called Hedgehog Leatherworks. And we ran profit first in our business. And the guy who invented the system, profit first, said, you know what? We can't do it. We can't do these numbers. It doesn't work for manufacturers. Until we said, my partner there and I, will trust the process. And we just did it. And we found something extraordinarily innovative. Now, I'm not going to tell you what it is. We're a leather manufacturer because we can't let out and we won't let out proprietary information. But let me tell you what happened, at least in part. In the leather industry, there's these things called clicker presses. You use them to cut out leather. And there's molding presses too, these heavy presses, sometimes applying tons of pressure down to leather to give them shape. Well, we depend upon these clicker presses and leather presses, but they're expensive. A clicker press, a new inexpensive one can go for $10,000. A heavy molding press, $50,000. And when we ran profit first, there wasn't nearly enough money to afford a press, let alone lease one. So that's when we said we have to give up. And then we said, hold on, let's be optimistic. Let's use the Henry Ford line and think we can. So with a few $100s, we went to the local Home Depot and we explored around. We said, what can we get in spare parts? And we bought a mix of materials, well under $100 worth of stuff. They even had a microwave that cost like $50, a cheap college-sized microwave, like a college dorm room. And we tested things out. Well, I'm going to tell you the one thing that didn't work, but it'll give you a sense of things you can do. We took leather and we microwaved it. And here's the big hint. Do not microwave leather. It turns into like flubber or something. It becomes way too pliable. But it did give us the concept of applying heat. We call it superheating, a very economical method of heating leather very quickly, and it negates the need for traditional molding presses. It negates the need for many things. And now we can form leather and cut leather so much faster than any of our competitors. They still use clicker presses and molding presses, and we don't need it. And our items cost way less. We've developed a proprietary method. Here is the key for you. When you set these TAPs, it's going to force your business to cut expenses to a point where you may say, I can't do it. My industry can't do it. That is your opportunity to break the rules of your industry. We think we've changed manufacturing forever. Actually, we don't think it. We know it. And you can too. Whatever industry you're in, there is a better way. And now you're forcing yourself to do it. Think you can, know you can, and you will. Current allocation percentages, caps. Current allocation percentage, cap, is where your business is today. This is the number you will adjust slowly but consistently over time to get closer and closer to the TAPs. For example, the profit TAP for your business may be 20%, but your historical profit allocations may have been 0%. If that is you, don't fret, it's common. If you haven't made profit allocations until now, then your profit cap is 0%. For your company to join the fiscally elite, you will slowly, deliberately, and consistently move toward the TAPs. What you will do is move from 0% profit cap to 1%. Then, next quarter, you'll move your cap to 3%. And then next quarter, 5%. Some people hear what I just shared about caps, but still think, I've been told to go big or go home. So I'm going all in and taking every stinking penny for my profit. And me. If you hoard most of the food at the table for yourself, you're not leaving any fuel for your business. Remember, your business, not you, is now living off the leftovers. But your leftovers have to be enough for your business to continue to thrive. The key to successful profit-first implementation lies in stringing together a series of many small steps in a repeating pattern. So take it easy. While you slowly start to build up your profit-first muscle, we are also going to get you into a simple repeating pattern. Entrepreneurs typically manage their money in an erratic, noisy rhythm that causes confusion and panic. But by the end of the next chapter, we will get you into a simple rhythm that will give you clarity and control over your financials. Let's dig in. your profit target allocation percentage, profit TAP. The incident assessment is a starting point for all of your target allocation percentages, TAPs. If you're the analytical type, you can refine the TAPs to be even more specific to your industry. This is not necessary, by the way, because TAPs are simply targets. As you move along and adjust your CAPs, remember, that's current allocation percentages, you will naturally find what works for you. Now you need to do a little bit of research to set more specific target numbers. There are a few ways to approach this. One, research public companies. Look at the financial reports public companies are required to make available. Do a quick internet search using the term financial market overview, and you will find dozens of websites that report the financials for public companies. Look up at least 5 companies in your industry or a similar industry. If you don't find your niche, try expanding. For instance, if you find no public DJ companies, expand to entertainment companies and select 5 that come close. Here's a little tip for you. My preference is MarketWatch.com. So that was MarketWatch.com for these reports because the site is easy to navigate. You might also try Yahoo Finance or Google Finance. For our purposes, look up the income statements for the last 3 to 5 years. If you really want to dig in, check out the balance sheets and cash flow statements for these companies too. For each year, divide the profit number by the total sales/revenue number. Then come up with the average. This is how you find the profit percentage for any public company. Do this for each of the 5 public companies you look at, and you will find the overall industry profit average. Use that overall industry profit average as your profit TAP. 2. Review your tax returns for the last 3 to 5 years and determine your most profitable year, based on percentages, not on dollar amounts. Why do we want the percentage? Because a billion-dollar company that reports only $1 million in profit is in big trouble. Even if it had only one bad day, $1 million wouldn't be enough to bail it out. But a $5 million company that reports $1 million in profit is kicking butt and taking names. That little old company spits out bad days. 3. Or, the easiest way, just pick your profit percentage number based on your projected revenue for this year using revenue for the last 12 months from the incident assessment form you filled out for Chapter 4. You did do that, right? Remember, the form is also available for free on my website. I've mentioned this before at the resources section at mikemikalowicz.com. Perhaps you will never quite reach the TAPs to which you aspire, but they will force you to constantly think about what you are doing and how you are doing it so that you do get closer. Or maybe you can beat the TAPs. Maybe you can become the new industry standard for TAPs. That would be badass. When you do surpass your TAPs, tell me about it. I want to tell everyone else to elevate his or her game. Because at this point, your profit account will fund your profit distributions and serve as a rainy day fund, you'll want your CAP to grow past 5% quickly. If you save 5% of your company's annual income, for example, that represents about 21 days of operating cash, which would help keep your business afloat if your income were to plummet. If your income dried up and you would stop contributing to your profit account and tax account and stop profit distributions to owners. 3 weeks is not much time to fix the problem, but Armageddon rarely happens. More often, revenue slows down over time, and you'll have at least something coming in during lean times, kind of like a hang-nail-ageddon instead of an Armageddon. I know that's a bad joke, but I like it, so it stays. If your sales were to stop completely, with not a single deposit coming in, here's a good longevity rule of thumb. 5% profit allocation equals 3 weeks of operating cash. A 12% profit allocation equals about 2 months of operating cash. And a 24% profit allocation equals 5 months of operating cash. Why is it that as the profit allocation percentages basically double, business longevity almost triples? The math doesn't seem to make sense at first glance, but it does make sense. The bigger your profit allocation percentage, the more efficiently you are running your business, which means less in operating expenses. So not only do you have more saved up with a higher PF percentage, you spend less, which affords you even more time. Fat margins draw stiff competition. The goal is to make your profit allocation percentage as high as possible. However, super high profit percentages are not sustainable, at least not for long, and definitely not if your revenue stays stagnant. The reason for this is that if you can pull off consistently fat profits, say 50% allocated to profit and only 10% of revenue to your operating expenses, your competitors will figure out what you're doing. Then, to get more business, they will drop prices. They likely have the profit margins to afford it. When that happens, you will have to drop prices too in order to stay in business. For competitive sharks, fat margins can be like blood in the water. The only way to keep big margins is to milk them for all they are worth when you have them and keep innovating to find new ways to bump up profitability. Owner's comp tap. Gone are the days when you paid everyone but yourself and had to support your life with credit cards and loans from the in-laws. Remember, your business is supposed to serve you. You are not in service to your business. No more leftovers for you. Owner's comp is the amount you and the other equity owners take and pay for the work you do. I suspect you are familiar with the term owner-operator, which means you own the business, you have equity, and you operate the business. You work as an employee for your own company. Owner's comp is the money we reserve for you and any other owner-operators of the business to get paid for the work you do for the company. Equity members of your company who do not work in the business just get a profit distribution. Your salary should be on par with the going rate for the work you do. In other words, the salary you would have to pay your replacement. There are two options to consider when choosing your owner's comp tap number. Either, one, take a realistic look at the work you do. If you have a small company with, say, 5 employees, you may call yourself the CEO, but that's just the title on your card. It's likely you are doing a lot of other work. You probably spend a lot of time selling, completing projects, handling customers, and dealing with human resources, HR, concerns. In reality, around 2% of your time is spent actually doing the job of CEO, vision planning, strategic negotiations, acquisitions, reporting to investors, addressing the media, etc. Determine your salary based on what you are doing 80% of the time and what you would reasonably pay employees to do those jobs. Then evaluate pay for all equity owners who work in the business. Out of the salaries that represent your owner's comp draw, the percentage of revenue that you set as your owner's comp tap must, at minimum, cover owner's comp draw. Remember, you will likely get raises, maybe even a bonus for a job well done. So make the percentage 1.25 times the amount you determine for your salaries so you can adjust for revenue fluctuations. Say you work with 4 equity owners in a business with a revenue of $1 million who draw a salary of $50,000 each. You need to set your owner's comp tap to at least 25%. Make sense? Good. Okay. Or, number 2, pick the percentage I suggested in the instant assessment based on your revenue range. This, as you remember, was in Figure 4. The money that is transferred into this account is divided among all equity employees. It does not have to be split up equally, nor does it have to be split up based on your equity percentages. The owner's comp is a negotiated agreement. Why should you have a separate account if you and the other equity owners working in the business are just employees? Because you are the most important employee. If you had to fire people, I suspect you would fire everyone else before you fired yourself. Think about your very best employee. I'll bet you take extra steps to ensure that you are taking care of that person. I'll bet you would do everything in your power to keep your best employee happy, including paying them what they're worth, right? Well, guess what, bucko? You are your best, most important employee. We must take care of you. And I got to tell you, I do so many presentations on Profit First. I think last year, well, I shared some of the statistics. 25 to 50 keynotes were on Profit First. Sometimes I talk about The Pumpkin Plan or Surge or my other books, but it's usually Profit First right now. And what I'll do during the presentation, I'll ask in the audience, particularly when it's a smaller audience, who has employees here. It's mostly business owners in the audience. And people, of course, will raise their hands. I'll pick out someone, usually in the front row. So here's a little tip for you. If you don't want to be picked on, don't sit in the front row. But usually toward the front row, because that's where I can see him. And I'll say, hey, what's your name? And she'll say, my name is Joan. I'll say, Joan, how many employees do you have? Oh, I have 5 or 6 employees. Hey, Joan, tell me, who's your best employee? And she'll say, you know, it's Mark. Mark is amazing. I'll ask another person in the audience, point to him, and his name was Chris, we'll say. I'll say, Chris, tell me who your best employee is. Chris will say, oh, it's Dave. Dave is amazing. And then I go back to Joan and Chris and say, Joan, you are liars. You are total liars. I don't know you. We've never done this magic trick together before. There's no rehearsal, but I know you're lying to me because you are the best employees. And they kind of look at me and they kind of start shaking their head, yes, or nodding their head, I should say. Yes, yes, I am. And now think about this, a business owner. Think about it for yourself. As a business owner, I suspect without seeing you, without knowing you, with just talking to you through an audio book, I suspect I know a little bit about your life as a business owner. I suspect you work at times ridiculous hours. I suspect you've worked through lots of weekends. I suspect you've sacrificed family times, perhaps even missed your children's sports or activities, your spouse's activities. I bet you've even worked through holidays and other things just like that. And you've done it for no pay, right? Am I right? I know I'm right because this is the life of the entrepreneur. Now, that, by the way, is the definition of the world's greatest employee. I want to hire you desperately. If you are willing to work through holidays and weekends, do extraordinary things, do whatever it takes to support the business, sacrifice your family, and do it all for no pay, man, I want you. You are the best. And of course, you won't do it for me because my business is my business and yours is yours. So for your business, there is no one that's willing to put in that amount of effort like you do. There's no one as committed as you are. You have to understand you truly are the best employee. We got to treat you that way. You would never treat your quote unquote best employee, someone who actually works for your firm but doesn't own it, by saying, we're going to stop paying you, now work harder. That would be absurd. They don't deserve that. And I'm saying you don't deserve it either. That's why we're setting up owner's comp. That's why we're committed to paying you a salary. Okay, I had to get fired up there. I hope you learned the lesson. Let's get back to the book. When it comes to pay, different business formations require you to take owner's comp in different ways. An S-corp is different from an LLC, a limited liability company, or sole proprietorship, which are both treated way differently than a C-corp. And if you're listening to this book internationally outside the U.S., there's different formations too. I realize that and I appreciate that. But the owner's comp allocation still works the same way. Regardless of the formation you have, you just need to work with your accountant to make sure the money flows out properly and legally. I strongly recommend an accountant who is a certified Profit First professional who knows exactly how to support your Profit First business and knows exactly how to address these nuances. It's very important you get it right, but it's definitely doable. Just do it with the right person. Don't underpay your most important employee. I was having dinner with my friend Rodrigo when he told me how his business generated $350,000 in annual revenue, but he was living on below minimum wage. As a thunderstorm approached in the distance, I took the napkin with the fewest salsa stains and jotted down Rodrigo's numbers. Multiplying his $350,000 in real revenue by 35%, that's from the instant assessment, I came up with just over $122,000. How many partners work in the business? I asked. Me and one other, he replied. Dividing by 2, the amount for the owner's comp was a little more than $61,000 each, but that was if they were doing the same work, warranting a 50-50 split. As we discussed in the previous section, owner's comp should represent the work you do. When I asked Rodrigo for more details about his own pay, he said, I take roughly $30,000 a year, and my partner left to get a full-time job, so he takes 0 now. We have 3 full-time employees at $65,000 each per year, and I manage them. I'd like to say I was shocked, but this scenario is all too common. How is Rodrigo supporting himself and his family on below minimum wage? I figured he was using credit cards, family loans, and possibly a home refinance to supplement his paltry income. If all three of your employees decide to leave on the same day, what would you do? I asked. I would do all the work myself, and my partner would come back. So why don't you do that? I asked. Because then I'd be stuck doing the work, and it would not be able to grow, Rodrigo explained. I don't want to do the work. I want to grow the business. Rodrigo had the right idea, but he was executing it in the wrong way. Michael Gerber, in his classic must-read book, and I am telling you, you've got to read this book if you haven't yet, it's called The E-Myth Revisited, explains that we should work on the business, not in the business. This on versus in philosophy is spot on, and yet most entrepreneurs have trouble executing it. Now, I just want to take a quick aside here. Before we continue the book, I actually want to share a quick story of an experience I had with Michael Gerber. Michael Gerber, as I said, is the author of The E-Myth Revisited, a must-read book. And I met up with him, coincidentally, in Mexico City. It was actually facilitated by Rodrigo, who lives in Monterrey, Mexico, but was visiting in Mexico City. We sat down for dinner, Michael and I, and we're having a chat. And I lauded on about how much I love his book. It really is that good. But I also said, I have one thing that there's a problem or challenge that I have with the book, basically. And I wanted to put it on the table. And Michael said, yeah, sure. What's the challenge for the book? And I said, the problem that I see is when I read it for the first time, I thought I had to immediately stop working in the business and start working on the business. Like it was a switch. And other entrepreneurs I know feel that it's a switch, that they just try to stop working in the business and start working on it immediately. And that doesn't work that way. It's more of a throttle. And Michael looked at me in the eye, and his exact words were, F you. And he said the full F word. He goes, F you. And then he started eating again. Now, if you don't know Michael Gerber, you'd be like, well, that's kind of weird. If you do know Michael Gerber, that's classic Michael Gerber. He is awesome. He's in your face. He's funny. He's eccentric. And after he said that and started eating, he looked up and said, you know, you make a good point. And we discussed about this throttling. And the concept is this. Yes, you must work on your business. But when you're a small business,